Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. This episode is technically a part two to the last episode I released. While you don't need to listen to that episode to enjoy this one, it will help paint a better picture of what's going on. But what exactly is this episode going to be about? Glad you asked. We're going to be taking a look at the reign of one of the most famous Egyptian pharaohs of all time, Tutankhamun, aka King Tut. While the events of his death, which are still fairly hidden in the shrouds of ancient history, and the eventual unearthing of his tomb millennia afterwards are what Tutankhamun are most well known for, the decade he spent on the throne as King of Egypt was also very important for the land he ruled over. We'll get more into this in the background history lesson, but it's generally believed that Tutankhamun was either the son or a close male relative to the pharaoh Akhenaten, whose reign I covered last episode. Akhenaten was infamous for trying to do away with the Egyptian pantheon of gods in order to establish sole worship over a single solar deity called the Aten. Well, this change in Egypt's history was only successful for the less than two decades Akhenaten was on the throne and a couple years afterwards. But Tutankhamun's rule would see Egypt once more undergo a cultural shift as the strained threads Akhenaten posthumously held over Egypt finally snapped. And of course, I'll later get into the history surrounding Tutankhamun's more modern ventures, meaning the discovery of his royal tomb and everything that comes with that. Also, if you hadn't noticed, I don't really want to be calling him King Tut. Just doesn't necessarily rub me the right way. So, without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to ancient Egypt in the early 14th century BCE in unearthing the rule of Tutankhamun. Alright, let's begin the background history lesson by figuring out how we get to Tutankhamun dealing with the death throes of Atenism, a term I'll explain in just a second. Well, the pharaoh Akhenaten ascended to the throne of Pharaoh roughly around 1352 BCE, give or take a couple years. He originally had the pharaonic name Amenhotep IV and ruled as a fairly inconspicuous leader of his people. After a few years, he changed his name to Akhenaten in order to fully throw his support behind the solar deity known as the Aten. Now, the Aten was actually just the Egyptian name for any sort of disc-shaped thing. In a more religious sense, it referred to the sun disc, a symbol closely associated with the sun god Ra. The Aten was probably even considered an offshoot of Ra and a god in its own right after a certain point. Well, Akhenaten was a deeply devoted follower of the Aten and decided to make that Egypt's problem. Before Akhenaten's reign, and in the first few years of his rule, Egypt was mostly under the control of the cult of Amun, the patron god of the Egyptian capital Thebes and the king of the Egyptian gods. The cult was so powerful that it's believed that they more or less controlled the economy in Egypt. Akhenaten decided to step in and cut the cult of Amun down to size, and then do away with them altogether. In a very bold move on his part, Akhenaten decreed that the Aten was now the god of all creation, king of the gods, and, more importantly, the only god the people of Egypt could worship. Prayers to any other deity were considered heresy. Akhenaten also decided to move the capital of his kingdom from Thebes to a city he ordered to be built, Akhetaten, more commonly known as Amarna. Thus begins what is rightfully known as the Amarna period. Now, there's a debate among historians as to the efficacy and actual state of Atenism, the sole worship of the Aten that Akhenaten decreed as the new state religion of Egypt. Did Akhenaten actually decree that the other gods didn't exist? Or did they exist but you couldn't worship them? If you just Google Akhenaten, you'll probably be told it was the former, but we can't say that for certain. Also, there's a growing theory and agreement among historians of ancient Egypt that people in Akhenaten's kingdom kinda just continued to worship the gods of their ancestors, just now very much privately within their own homes. Akhenaten then passed away sometime around 1335 BCE. It's here where history gets a little murky. We have the name of two pharaohs who were said to rule within this period, Smenkhkare and Neferneferuaten. We don't actually know who these people were, at least not for certain. We can't even really say for certain who ruled first or if they served as co-rulers of Egypt during the few years between Akhenaten and Tutankhamun. It's also possible that one or both served as co-rulers alongside Akhenaten. Smenkhkare is usually only thought to have ruled as the lone pharaoh of Egypt for a single year after the death of Akhenaten before he too passed away. The only thing of note we know about the guy is that he built an addition onto the royal palace in Amarna that is named after him. Otherwise, theories abound about his identity. It's anything from Akhenaten's brother or son to a man that Smenkhkare's predecessor took on as a lover who ended up inheriting the throne. It is generally believed, though, that Smenkhkare was related to Akhenaten and married to the pharaoh's daughter, Meritaten. There's also a theory that Smenkhkare was actually a woman pretending to be a man, possibly Meritaten or Akhenaten's great royal wife, Nefertiti. After all, Egypt had already dealt with a similar case a few pharaohs previously, with Hatshepsut ordering that she be depicted as a man in order to further solidify her rule. Neferneferuaten is perhaps even more shrouded in secrecy than Smenkhkare. All we can pretty much say for certain is that she was a woman, and even that's not 100% guaranteed. The general working theory is that Neferneferuaten was either Nefertiti or Meritaten ruling as the sole queen of Egypt. Obviously, the name Neferneferuaten and Nefertiti are a little close, so she could have just slightly changed it for her own rule. There's also theories that whoever was Neferneferuaten, be it Nefertiti or someone else, was also Smenkhkare. She would have ruled secretly as a man for a year before deciding to do away with the lie and rule as a woman in her own right. But that's all just a theory. We only have inscriptions bearing this pharaoh's name, and unfortunately, not much else to go on. But let's move on from theories. Well, for the most part, and move back into the realm of history we can actually talk about in depth. Because after the messy post-Akhenaten section of the Amarna period, Egypt will need a new king in order to get things back on track. Tutankhamun was born around 1341 BCE. Well, actually at birth, his name was either Tutankhaten or Tutankhuaten. His father was possibly Akhenaten, we think. Okay, so let's get back into the realm of theories. In the Valley of the Kings, where the 18th dynasty of Egypt, the dynasty of Hatshepsut, Akhenaten, and Tutankhamun were all buried, there's a site with a mummy referred to as KV-55. We can't with 100% certainty say who this mummy was, but it's believed to be Akhenaten. The mummy's tomb was defaced, most likely when it was placed in that tomb. When the Amarna period ended, we know that Akhenaten's original tomb in Amarna was sacked and he was buried somewhere in the Valley of Kings. KV-55 is thought to be his corpse, but again, it could be anyone associated with the Amarna period. Based on DNA testing, we are close to 100% sure that KV-55 is Tutankhamun's father. And as for his mother, that's even more of a mystery. Again, we have a mummy, but not a name. This mummy is referred to as KV-35, aka the Younger Lady. Based on DNA testing, we know this woman to be the mother of Tutankhamun. We also know that KV-35 was closely related to KV-55, almost certainly his sister. Given that the ancient royals of Egypt were infamous for sibling marriages, this kinda tracks. It used to be thought that KV-35 was Nefertiti, but for the most part, we don't think Nefertiti and Akhenaten were related, at the very least not siblings or even first cousins. Akhenaten had at least 8 sisters and married a few of them, meaning it's very difficult to pin down a name. We just know it wasn't a few of the other sisters because, Well, for the very unfortunate reason that they had been married to their father, Amenhotep III. While the true parentage of Tutankhamun will probably continue to be a mystery for some time, let's move back to talking about Tutankhamun himself. As I said, he was originally known as Tutankhaten, which makes sense considering that, even if he wasn't the direct son of Akhenaten, he was born into the nobility of the Amarna period. And as for his life before he became pharaoh, well, not much is known about that. Akhenaten and his successors for basically the rest of the 18th dynasty were put under damnatio memoriae, meaning that any mentions of them were scrubbed from official Egyptian records, which is ironic considering Tutankhamun and Akhenaten are two of the most famous pharaohs of all time. It's almost certainly likely that as a young child, Tutankhamun was given some sort of military training, what with him being a potential heir to the throne and all that. Other than that, we know that he was married at the age of 8 to his half-sister, Akhisenpaten, who would eventually change her name to Ankhensenamun. Ankhensenamun was the daughter of Akhenaten and Nefertiti. She was at least a couple years older than Tutankhamun and is sometimes said to have been born right around the time Akhenaten got around to his religious reforms. To make matters even weirder, she was also briefly married to her father. After Akhenaten's death, it's possible that Akhisenamun would go on to be one of the wives of Pharaoh Smenkhere. By the time both Smenkhere and Neferneferuaten died, it's believed that Akhisenamun was either the only surviving daughter of Akhenaten, or at least the oldest of his surviving daughters. The year after Tutankhamun got married, around 1332 BCE, either Neferneferuaten or Smenkhere, or both, passed away, leaving just 9 years old Tutankhamun as the rightful heir to the throne of Egypt. It was time for the reign of the boy king to begin. Okay, we all know that a 9-year-old can't actually rule a nation, and even at her oldest attested age, Ankhensenamun was only 16, still too young to be a full-fledged ruler. This means that the real power of Egypt was actually in the hands of two men who acted as Tutankhamun's advisors, courtier and longtime ally of the royal family Ai, and the general of the Egyptian army, Horemheb. A long-standing theory about Ai is that he may have been Nefertiti's father, therefore making him Tutankhamun's grandfather-in-law. Records show that Ai served in the court of Akhenaten and may have also served Akhenaten's father, Amenhotep III. It would then be likely to presume that he served both Smenkhere and Neferneferuaten. During the reign of Akhenaten, Ai had two very important titles, Overseer of all the horses of His Majesty, and Fanbearer on the right side of the king. That first title, Overseer of all the horses of His Majesty, was a military position that ranked Ai as the highest ranking member of the charioteer division of the Egyptian army. It was just below the rank of general. Fanbearer on the right side of the king meant that Ai was an incredibly close confidant of the pharaoh. If you watched Game of Thrones, think of it as a position similar to Hand of the King. Ai was also known as God's Father, which is a title that is still a bit puzzling to this date. Theories about the title point in many different directions. Some suggest this was actually a way of saying father-in-law, which would make sense if Ai was the father of Nefertiti. Others suggest that it meant he was a tutor for Akhenaten's children, including Tutankhamun. Meanwhile, Horemheb was thought to have been a commoner who quickly rose to prominence under Tutankhamun. Before becoming the pharaoh's commander-in-chief of the army, Horemheb had served as a minister of foreign affairs slash dignitary role, mostly seeming to have been influential when it came to Egypt's relationship with its southern neighbor, Nubia. His tomb does also mention his role as an important emissary with the nations north of Egypt as well, but we know for a fact that he visited Nubia. He had to have also served in some sort of military role, otherwise why would Tutankhamun make him leader of the military? The pharaoh seemed to greatly trust Horemheb as he too was given the title of fanbearer on the right side of the king. He was also given a title that has a bit of murky meaning depending on translation. That title is Iripat. It's usually translated as Hereditary Prince, which would make you think Horemheb was actually nobility, but Horemheb himself would later very much state that he was just a commoner. That title, however, can also just mean someone who's a high-ranking noble. It's entirely possible that Horemheb just worked his way up through obscurity to become the pharaoh's right-hand man. Horemheb's rise would be so meteoric that it's believed that Tutankhamun, who never had any sons, wished Horemheb to be his successor. Both I and Horemheb must have been men who recognized that Atenism could never thrive any longer in Egypt. We don't know anything really about Horemheb before Tutankhamun's reign, at least not anything definitive, so it's entirely possible that he was always anti-Atenism. For I, this is a little bit more surprising. After all, he maintained his close relationship with the pharaohs even after Akhenaten's death, so why not intervene sooner? Well, we know that either one or both were against the religion, because it did not take very long into Tutankhamun's rule before decrees made by Akhenaten in the name of the Aten started being reversed. And as I said before, Tutankhamun was far too young to be making sweeping religious reforms within the Kingdom of Egypt. By the third year of his rule, the pharaoh officially changed his name from Tutankhaten to the recognizable Tutankhamun, thereby fully showing that his rule would see an end to the Amarna period. Based on a stela dated to the fourth year of Tutankhamun's reign, that year the religious cults of the other Egyptian gods were finally allowed to start practicing once more, with priests and priestesses being restored to their positions they held before the Amarna period. That same year, Tutankhamun and his court abandoned his father's capital city and moved the seat of power back to Memphis, which had been the Egyptian capital in more ancient pharaonic dynasties. Truly, the Amarna period that had come to be known as a dark age for those alive in Egypt had finally come to an end. Much of the rest of Tutankhamun's decade-long reign, give or take a year, is still relatively unknown to us. I'll be upfront about this before I try to continue on with Tutankhamun while he's still alive within the narrative, and then I'll circle around to the topic later. For many years, historians believed that Tutankhamun was severely physically disabled. This is still an idea that's tossed around in modern times. However, the severity of any disabilities he may have been born with or would later come to live with may be overestimated. This mostly plays into trying to figure out Tutankhamun's role in the military of Egypt. He was buried with many weapons and military paraphernalia, suggesting that he had an active role in the military. There are monuments built during Tutankhamun's reign that praise him for participation in two different wars, one in the south in Nubia and one in the north in the Middle East. If Tutankhamun was indeed physically handicapped, he probably would not have actually fought in these battles, instead being a figurehead there for moral support. However, there are plenty of Egyptologists who make an argument that the young pharaoh did indeed participate in warfare, especially towards the end of his reign when he was closer to adulthood. Unless we get a better idea on possible damage to the pharaoh's body post-mortem, we'll probably never have a concrete answer on how military savvy Tutankhamun actually was. Moving aside from military affairs, as stated before, much of Tutankhamun's reign was spent reversing the rule of Akhenaten. This meant building up the old cults and the temples used by the other Egyptian deities. Tutankhamun doled out endowment to other cults in order to revitalize the religious life of his kingdom. This meant continuing once more on the never-ending expansion to the Karnak temple complex in Thebes. Fun fact, the Karnak complex would continue to be built upon through the time of the Ptolemaic dynasty about 1,000 years after Tutankhamun's death. It's believed that Tutankhamun's construction projects made heavy use of recycling the limestone blocks that had been used by Akhenaten for the construction of Amarna. Akhenaten had used a specific type of limestone that was very easy to use in building, but it was also very easy to take down. Now, whether using the building blocks of Amarna for Tutankhamun's building project was his idea or that of his advisors is unknown. And as a final note for the reign of Tutankhamun, he received the very uncommon honor of being worshipped as a god within his own time. Normally, the pharaoh was just a figure that acted as the intermediary between humans and the gods. It was very rare for a pharaoh to actually be worshipped as a god themselves while he or she was alive. Temples dedicated to Tutankhamun have even been found in modern-day Sudan. A stela at Karnak is even dedicated to the deified Tutankhamun, where citizens could possibly pray to the pharaoh for cleansing of any perceived sins. After the reign of Akhenaten, but before the reign of 19th dynasty pharaohs like Ramses the Great, it would be easy to think of Tutankhamun's reign as somewhat low-key. After all, he was just a child when he was crowned as pharaoh, and most of the policies of his reign were no doubt enacted by advisors. However, the ending of the Amarna period was incredibly important for Egypt as it helped the kingdom get back on track from the hiccup that had been Tutankhamun's father. And who knows what could have happened if he lived longer. Maybe he just would have ruled in mediocrity. Maybe as an adult, Tutankhamun would have been claimed by the same zealotry as his father. I guess at the end of the day, we'll never know, because the boy king would be dead before he even hit 20 years old. Tutankhamun's death at the age of 19, around 1323 BCE, is shrouded in mystery. If anyone in the past wrote about how the pharaoh died, that information has been lost to history. Because of that, countless theories have been thrown around as to what happened to Tutankhamun. To quickly throw out one theory and then basically disprove it, there was a thought that the pharaoh was murdered, possibly by being struck on the back of the head. This was due to research done on Tutankhamun's mummy in the 1960s that showed damage in that area. This has now been debunked and thought that the damage to Tutankhamun's skull resulted from damage after we unearthed his body. We've had his mummy for over a century now. Despite our best efforts, damage was bound to happen at some point. Now we go back to a topic I talked about earlier, and that would be Tutankhamun's overall health. In more modern times, doctors and historians have theorized about all sorts of maladies the pharaoh may have suffered from based on testing done on his body, as well as other information we can glean from his tomb. Most people in the field tend to agree that Tutankhamun had scoliosis and contracted some form of malaria. Another diagnosis that many agree upon is osteonecrosis, the destruction of body tissues in the bones. Body scans seem to show that Tutankhamun's legs were fairly weakened, probably from osteonecrosis. This has led to the modern theory that Tutankhamun was suffering from a pretty harsh case of malaria, and then possibly also fractured his leg, which was already in a weakened state. The fractured leg probably wasn't treated well enough, which caused an infection. The compound infection and malaria attacking Tutankhamun's body would then have killed him. The young pharaoh was laid to rest in the Valley of the Kings, where his body would remain for over 3,000 years. As I said before, it's believed by some that Tutankhamun meant for his advisor and military leader, Horemheb, to be his heir in the event that Tutankhamun did not have any children. Well, surely enough, Tutankhamun died childless. However, the throne did not go to Horemheb. In the immediate aftermath of the pharaoh's death, his other advisor, Ai, swooped in to take the throne. Ai helped conduct the burial rites on Tutankhamun and potentially even married the former pharaoh's wife, Ankhensen Amun. He continued on with the process of restoring the old religion to the Kingdom of Egypt. After Ai passed away, sometime around 1320 BCE, Horemheb stepped in to usurp the throne that possibly should have been his in the first place. He laid claim to several monuments that had been built by both Tutankhamun and Ai. And as he was not a blood relative of Tutankhamun and Ai, and would also die without siring any children, Horemheb would be laid to rest as the final pharaoh of the 18th dynasty. And time would pass, centuries, then millennia, after the pharaohs of the 19th dynasty struck the memory of Akhenaten and his successors from official records. The time surrounding the life of Tutankhamun would be lost to history. In November of 1922, the tomb of Tutankhamun was reopened for the first time in ages. The expedition that would go on to rediscover the long-forgotten pharaoh was led by a man named Howard Carter. Carter had been excavating sites in Egypt since 1907 under the employ of a British earl. By 1922, it was believed that the Valley of the Kings had since been completely excavated and had no further mysteries left unsolved. Carter's benefactor was becoming more convinced of this idea and decided he would only fund Carter's work through the end of the season. According to Mr. Carter, the tomb was discovered when a member of his team tripped over what they believed to be a rock. Carter's team soon discovered that it was not a rock, but the top of a staircase that descended further down into the entrance of a tomb. The team found a tomb that was almost completely intact with relics of gold scattered about with other priceless artifacts. It's believed now that Tutankhamun's tomb was previously robbed shortly after his death before being resealed. Eventually, rulers of the 20th dynasty would build their tombs over that of Tutankhamun, preventing any further intrusions and further obscuring the history of the young pharaoh. Over the next several years, Carter's team cataloged and extracted thousands of artifacts from Tutankhamun's tomb. It was the most pristine tomb to have ever been found in the Valley of Kings, and to this day remains the preeminent example of what a royal tomb in ancient Egypt was probably like. Barring the obvious examples of pyramid tombs. The most obvious of the prized artifacts was none other than the sarcophagus of Tutankhamun containing the pharaoh's mummy. The sarcophagus itself was made of solid gold and protected by several outer layers. Tutankhamun's death mask, perhaps the most iconic piece of Egyptian art, was also made of gold and other precious gems. Egyptians were buried with items that were thought to be necessary in the afterlife. Pharaohs were buried with essentially an entire palace that I guess would go with them into the realm of the dead. There were chairs and jewelry, as well as weapons and toys. Plenty of clothing, sometimes also made of gold, has also been found. There's a theory though that the tomb of Tutankhamun and some of its belongings were actually meant for someone older than the pharaoh himself. This could be due to a couple different reasons. First, and my personal theory, is that the tomb was originally meant for Tutankhamun when he had grown further into adulthood. No one had been expecting the King of Egypt to die at 19 years old. Another theory is that his tomb was originally meant for the pharaoh Smenkhere, but that mysterious king ended up being buried somewhere else. The discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb lit the world on fire. It was 1922. World War I had ended a few years ago, and the Great Depression was still a few years out. It's also said that the summer of 1922 was especially slow for news. So, when an archaeological site that was believed to be cleared out ended up finding the greatest historical find of all time, it made headlines all over the world. With everyone and their grandmother now reading about Pharaoh Tutankhamun, and most people being unable to pronounce that name, the boy king started being called by the much more famous title, King Tut. Tourists soon began flocking to the excavation site in lieu of other more famous historical sightseeing locations. The world was swept by a wave of Egyptomania, and Tutankhamun became the most famous pharaoh in history. I have a few thoughts and opinions on the fact that Tutankhamun's fame is basically tied to the existence of Howard Carter. If you've listened to this show for long enough, that's probably not surprising. He was a pharaoh who helped usher in a new age of Egyptian life, or at least helped bring back the old ways. I mean, not entirely, and it wasn't just him. If you didn't listen to the Akhenaten episode, then I'll say again here that Egypt never really returned to the way things were before the Amarna period. The pharaoh had far less religious authority, and the Egyptian people started taking religion into their own hands. But still, it's clear that Smenkhere and Neferneferuaten didn't really have any plans to end Akhenaten's legacy. It would be the role of the son to end the father's crimes. That is, if Tutankhamun was actually Akhenaten's son, and if you consider what Akhenaten did a crime. But still, the fact that Tutankhamun is famous because a white guy in the 1920s uncovered his tomb is kinda... well, it doesn't really sit right with me. Yeah, his tomb is one of the most pristine examples to have been discovered. But maybe it should have remained that way. After all, it was the resting place of a young man who didn't even make it to 20 years old. And even now, his body is put on display as a tourist attraction. Look, yeah, mummies are cool. It's incredible that we have mostly intact bodies from thousands of years ago. I just hope that they keep it in his tomb and eventually return all the other artifacts as well. Before 2007, Tutankhamun's body was separated from his final resting place. And as of 2022, there's possible plans to move his mummy to the Grand Egyptian Museum in Cairo. How about we don't do that, yeah? Or maybe this is just the ramblings of someone who doesn't like desecrating the remains of the dead. I may not believe in the gods of Egypt, but I still think it's a bit screwy to mess around with something that was very religiously important for the people of ancient Egypt. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show, tell a friend, and follow the Denim Creek page on Twitter and Instagram for more info about each episode. Next time, it's back to Rome to continue the Julio-Claudian saga. While Nero may be the new emperor, there's someone else in the picture who is very much seizing power in her own right. Because of her massive importance towards the end of the first Roman imperial dynasty, I think it's only fair that Nero's mother, Agrippina the Younger, gets her own episode. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.